It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today, we've a classically trained chef turned grill master who's reshuffling the old school rules. For instance, roughing up your meat before you grill to give you more crispy bits on the edges.
I want to create surface area. I want to create as much browning as possible. You create all these nooks and crannies, and you actually created this 3D cooking surface. And that's why I'll score into the meat before it's cooked, and that will increase the surface area, hence more flavor, more juiciness. It's fantastic.
Adam Perry Lang's book is Charred and Scruffed. Who would have thought? But it's this kind of mentality that shakes out the new ideas. Stick around for much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Iconoclasts are handy folks to have around when it comes to cooking. They get us to try new ideas. Now take barbecue and grilling. We know the basics, right? Well, maybe not right. Chef Adam Perry Lang claims that there are new and better ways to grill. Here's the curious piece of his story. Adam's a classically trained French chef who made his mark in starred restaurants in New York and Paris. Then he turned around and won major barbecue competitions with methods that had some pitmasters scratching their heads. Well, Adam's written Charred and Scruffed, Bold New Techniques for Explosive Flavor on and Off the Grill. And he joins us from London. Adam, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
You know, I've always thought that the best grilling is about two things. It's about a magnificent crust on the meat that tastes, you know, rich and brown, and about the meat being really juicy and evenly cooked all the way through. How do you get there?
It's a great question. And, you know, there's so many different ways to skin a cat, but I've gotten there by just trial and error. And I've just found this way where I kind of have this dialogue with the heat. And that's what I try to convey to some people. I know it sounds a little bit floofy, but, you know, a fire and smoke and heat in general outside, and when you're dealing with coals, wood, and fire, it's unruly. And it's not like turning on a stove. So you really have to engage yourself and figure out what's going on. I was fortunate enough to work with some fantastic chefs early on. And my understanding of meat and handling food and understanding balance and acidity, these are really important factors with barbecue and grilling, because usually the smoke and the flavor can be so bold that you really have to almost allow the food to keep up. So I really, I'd use techniques like hot potato technique where, you know, you describe it perfectly. You know, it's evenly cooked all the way through. Well, I'm constantly flipping the meat and developing the crust by doing that and layering it with, let's say, an herb brush, which I use quite a lot, and dipping in a basting sauce. So when I'm doing that, I'm flipping it and I'm constantly developing the crust, not drying it out, and also tempering that heat to go evenly all the way through.
And you're constantly sort of seasoning it because you're using a brush with a basting sauce.
It's really interesting because seasoning on the grill and the barbecue is a lot different than seasoning in a pan or in an oven that's direct on a direct surface. And I'll tell you why. Because when you're flipping on the grill, a lot of that seasoning just kind of peels off a bit onto the grill and it comes away from the meat. So as a result, that's one of the techniques I worked on, which is kind of developing the meat paste to prevent this, is seasoning a little bit ahead of time, let's say 10 minutes ahead, and allowing it to ooze a little bit. So then it creates this like glaze on the outside of the meat. And that's one of the keys to creating this beautiful crust.
So you're rubbing a seasoning into that meat, letting it sit for that 10 minutes.
Salt-based. Yeah, exactly.
So I also understand that you have your fire set up, so you have your fire on one side and a blank area on another, right?
I do that a lot, only because barbecue and grilling can be quite conversational, and you know, oftentimes you need that pause break or that moment just to kind of get that safe zone. So, you know, you learn your hot zones. And you can also do it by, if you don't have a safe zone, you can stack the meat. So let's say if you have like five steaks.
Right.
And you realize things are getting out of control. I'll literally just create a mountain of meat and then just rotate the bottom like, you know, like a tuna swimming, you know, kind of its point and then it goes to the end, you know, they
right,
kind of rotate.
The bottom goes
yeah.
to the top and it keeps
yeah.
rotating.
And I constantly, that's why I'm constantly moving. I'm an active griller. But look, you know, it's just like anything, you know, people with cooking, everybody has different styles and some are introverts and some are extroverts. On the grill, I'm an extrovert. I like a constant move. I like to talk. I like to be active. I know things are, you know, are not always the same. So that's how I really have fun. And and when you're having fun, that's how your food comes out good.
You use these terms, scruffing, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
What is scruffing?
It's a great thing to do, and it usually happens by mistake by a lot of people, and they get upset at themselves. They're looking, most people, and I don't know why, they just are so attracted to these grill marks. And to me, grill marks happen, but they're not the goal. In fact, they're not even the most desirable goal. So I want to create surface area. I want to create as much browning as possible, you know?
That crust.
So, yeah. So scruffing, it kind of came about by, you know, this concept of my grandmother in the kitchen. She's cooking a brisket and she's breaking all the rules. And it's sticking to the pan and she plunges a giant meat fork in it and rips it off the pan, you know, shredding the meat, flips it over, you know, smoke alarms are going off. but you know, it browns beautifully. It starts browning in the oven and it created all these nooks and crannies and you actually created this 3D cooking surface. And that's why I'll score into the meat before it's cooked. And that will increase the surface area, hence more flavor, more juiciness.
Fabulous idea.
It's fantastic. It works great.
Adam, you are changing my whole approach. hey, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Perry Lang's book is Charred and Scruffed, and you can find more detail on that scruffing technique. It's on the website, as well as Adam's recipe for a rib roast done like a steak. You'll find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. It's a shame about the palm trees. If Hawaii were ugly, people would pay more attention to the food. Now, you can eat there like nowhere else on the planet. I mean, what a culinary mix. These islands are 3,000 miles from anywhere, with a unique compression of cultures. Well, I've asked travel writer Peter John Lindbergh to join us. He did a piece on Hawaii's new wave food scene for Travel and Leisure magazine. Peter, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So, what is the new wave?
Well, I just spent a couple of weeks eating my way around Oahu and the Big Island, which is where the food scene is really concentrated. And I have to say, I was just thoroughly blown away. As you said, the food there is amazing, and chefs in Hawaii are just firing on all cylinders these days. There's really exciting things happening. The new wave, well, a bit of background first, if I can. It started about the Hawaiian food really first hit its big creative stride back in the early 90s with what was then called Hawaii Regional Cuisine. You had chefs like Alan Wong, Roy Yamaguchi, Sam Choi, mixing up French techniques with native Hawaiian ingredients, what we now maybe would just call fusion, and mixing in some Asian flavors. And what they came up with was really a whole new style of cooking, especially in terms of homegrown Hawaiian foods. We're talking things like guava smoked rack of lamb or foie gras with pineapple coulis. Things like that. Now, the Hawaiian regional cuisine was hugely influential and went way beyond Hawaii itself. Alan Wong and Roy Yamaguchi really became celebrity chefs because of that. And they're still in the scene today. They're very much still tremendously popular, and that food really still defines the fine dining, the high-end dining in Hawaii. But But now what you're seeing is a real passing of the torch to a new generation of chefs and farmers and food purveyors who are building on that approach. And the biggest change is about affordability, which if you've been to Hawaii and eaten out there, you know, that is a big issue for a lot of visitors. It has been very expensive dining out there traditionally because it is an island and just because the price point is a little higher. The younger chefs are working at a more approachable and accessible level, not just in terms of price point, but in terms of the presentation, the service style, the whole atmosphere. It's a lot like what you're seeing across the United States now with the sort of casualization of American dining. So they're more likely to be cooking out of like a lunch truck or a farmer's market stand or even a pop-up restaurant somewhere, rather than doing the classic sort of white tablecloth Waikiki right. resort restaurants.
So give me an idea of what these dishes are about.
Well, we're seeing a leaning away from the European influence and more just toward that homegrown Hawaiian traditional foods. You know, for example, there's a wonderful luau stew, which is this kind of classic Hawaiian grandmother dish with these chunks of super tender slow-cooked pork and onions and sort of a bitter sour taro leaf, which is, tastes kind of like a spinach crossed with fenugreek.
Mm.
It has this wonderfully elemental comfort food kind of flavor. And you're seeing dishes like that now being presented instead of these more refined, you know, plated with tweezers kind of thing that you would get in the fancier restaurants.
Who are the players and what are their specialties?
Well, one of the guys is this really remarkable young Hawaiian chef named Mark Noguchi, who made that very luau stew that I was raving about. He's out at a place called Heia Pier, which is on the east coast of Oahu. It's basically just like a fishing shack out at the end of this rusted-out fishing pier that's part bait-and-tackle shop and part down-home diner, kind of as casual as it gets, this salty sea dog place. And what he's doing is he's kind of taking the plate lunch, the Hawaiian workaday comfort food like that luau stew, but he's elevating it to a whole new level. He's using organic ingredients and great local produce and fresh fish caught that morning. And as I said earlier, the price point is different. Nothing on his menu costs more than $12.
Huh.
So one of the best meals we had was at this like incredibly rustic, ramshackle little joint that, you know, you would never have expected this kind of really refined and great cooking. Super creative.
This sounds great. I remember food trucks being a big thing there long before they were, you know, being done anywhere else. It was just the way food was sold. What's happening with the food trucks?
The food trucks are have just exploded in recent years. There used to be, I think 3 years ago, there were 90 that were registered, and now there are something more than 250, I think. And each month they actually have this wonderful food truck rally where they gather in a parking lot and sort of just have this all-night party where people can go from truck to truck and order and sit on blankets and have a picnic-style dinner. And there's some really amazing ethnic foods being done with that in terms of just Korean, you know, the Korean burgers and the kimchi tacos and all sorts of mashups and sort of fusion-y kind of food being done at this really affordable level.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Lynn.
Peter John Lindbergh writes about travel for Travel and Leisure and other magazines. His Hawaii piece appeared in Travel and Leisure's May 2012 issue. Well, speaking of restaurants, I had a knockout dish recently in Salt Lake City. The restaurant was Fresco Italian Cafe, and the dish was a Tuscan pasta called Peachy. That's spelled P-I-C-I. Now, these are hand-rolled short twists of dough. You roll strips of dough lightly between your palms. Done right, they're light but chewy. Done wrong, they're lead sinkers. Well, Fresco chef Logan Crew got them right, and he tossed the peachy with a few spring onions, several little balls of wild mushrooms that were so good they could have stood on their own, and the last touch was the chicken broth in the bottom of the bowl. A pecorino cheese rind had been cooked in it, so you got just a hint of cheese. What a great idea to try. Well, I'm going to put the name of the restaurant and the dish up on the website. That's splendidtable.org. And we're going to be back with food scientist Harold McGee, who is doing the unthinkable with frozen food. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Food science takes you a long way down the road to dishes that always shine. Chefs understand this, which is why many well-known ones work with food scientist Harold McGee. He's always digging for new answers and never accepting the status quo. Well, Harold's latest book is Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. Harold, it's great to have you back with us.
It's wonderful to be back with you, Lynn. Thanks.
You know, I want to talk to you about thawing food fast because you did an article about thawing meat in hot water. And, I mean, all the experts have always said never in a million years should you ever thaw meat in hot water. You always do it in cold water. So what's the deal?
Well, that's exactly it. And in fact, most of the time what people told you to do is thaw leaving things in the refrigerator. Which is, in a way, the worst of all possible worlds for the cook because, yeah, that might be the safest way to do something, but it takes forever. I mean, a one-inch thick steak can take 24 hours to thaw out in
right.
the refrigerator. So the next best thing was to put it in cold water, ice water, and water is just a much better transmitter of heat than air is. And so when you put something in water, it'll transfer heat in or out of the food much more quickly. And so you can thaw a piece of beef in cold water. It might take 24 hours in the fridge. It would take maybe 1 hour, 2 hours in cold water. But that's still quite a while. And the thing that I think most authorities were worried about was people just kind of taking food out of the fridge, putting it on the countertop and letting it warm up at room temperature, which takes a long time and isn't safe because bacteria can grow at the surface of the food while the inside is still thawing out. But then about 18 months ago, two different food science labs actually did a controlled study to see what would happen when you thawed meat at different temperatures in water baths. And what they discovered was that meat, 1-inch thick steak, will thaw in about 20 minutes in room temperature water and more like 10 or 11 minutes in water that's 100 degrees or so, so like a hot summer day.
Right, right.
And it turns out that if you do the math, which these labs did, those thawing times are so short that they don't give bacteria a chance to get growing and cause any trouble. So it turns out that thawing in 100-degree water is perfectly safe.
Okay, so if we're going to do this at home, what would be the exact method we should use?
Well, first of all, the method should only really be used for relatively small cuts of meat, like steaks, chops, chicken breasts, chicken legs, things like that. Not whole birds, not whole roasts, because those still, even in hot water, will take hours to thaw all the way to the center. And so it should really only be for these smaller cuts of meat and fish. And what you want to do is actually start the water hotter because the second study that I had seen actually tried it in 125 or 130-degree water,
uh-huh.
and that works well and even faster. So what I like to do is just get the water hot from the tap, and that's usually around, in my house, around 120 degrees, and then have a lot of water compared to the weight of the meat. So a big stock pot full of water, and then put the meat in, immerse it, put something on it like a saucer or a slotted spoon just to keep it submerged.
Mm-hmm.
And then every once in a while come over and give it a stir because you will get hot and cold spots if the water just sits quietly by itself and the thawing won't be as quick and efficient as it would be otherwise. And then in 15 minutes, depending on the thickness of the meat, it should be ready to go.
What about packaging? Because if I take something right out of the freezer, sometimes I wrap first in freezer plastic wrap, then I wrap again. Should I leave it in that wrapping or should I transfer the stuff into something different for the thawing?
Well, the thawing is slowed down by anything that's between the meat and the water. And so it'll be most efficient to thaw if the meat is simply in a single thickness piece of plastic film, or if you've kind of packaged it yourself and swaddled it in layers and layers, take off the swaddling and just put it in a Ziploc bag. And that way the heat will be transferred from the water into the meat much more rapidly.
You have just opened up possibilities for home cooks on weeknights that are untold. Harold, thank you. This is great.
My pleasure.
Food scientist Harold McGee is author of Keys to Good Cooking. Now, one frozen recipe you should leave frozen is Jenny Brittenbauer's lemon frozen yogurt. Like Harold McGee, she's investigated the science here and she's ended up with an outstanding result. Find lemon frozen yogurt on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our quarterly ebook, Eating In with Lynn, Volume 2. It's all about summer parties. And it's there on the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, and don't forget to put our summertime grilling guide to use as well. We've curated a bunch of recipes to make your life at the grill a little easier this year. So check out the details. You know where. The website, splendidtable.org. Newcomers to Jane and Michael Stern may not realize their three decades of selfless sacrifice. They've stocked the best road food in the USA, and it hasn't been all homemade root beer and tender biscuits. It's more like Pepto-Bismol and hockey puck pies. They've suffered a lot to find the gems, but they deliver those gems every week to their road food site and here. Hey, Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys.
Hey, Len.
Hi, Len.
Hey, what's up with barbecue? What have you found?
You know, Lynn, it used to be that living in the Northeast, as we do, we always felt we had to go far away to get good barbecue. We had to go to North Carolina or Texas, and that was the case, but less and less so these days. In fact, there are some really good barbecues actually all over the country, and lucky for us, there's one not too far from where we live in Wingdale, New York, which is sort of on the Connecticut-New York border.
Uh-huh.
It started, as many good barbecues do, as just a truck that was pulled to an intersection on weekends. And Warren Norstein would set up his barbecue pit and cook barbecue, and when he sold out, he would leave for the day. But recently, he actually made a brick-and-mortar store of it, and you can go there and eat barbecue 7 days a week.
So what style does he do? I mean, what kind of barbecue are we talking
here?
The
best style.
The best. Helps me a lot.
Very smoky.
Very smoky.
Burnt ends, brisket, cracklings. I mean, the real heavy-duty stuff.
Well, in other words, he's not locked into Memphis style or North Carolina style or West Texas style. He really does a kind of potpourri from around the country, but does it really well. I mean, the pulled pork there is some of the tenderest, sweetest and very smoky pulled pork I've had anywhere.
You know, the place it reminds me the most of is Speed Queen in Milwaukee with their incredibly wonderful burnt ends.
Yes, the burnt ends here are spectacular. And one of the things
you know what that is, Lynn, don't you?
Burnt ends? Yeah, well, that's okay. Usually – that's the trimmings and the bits and pieces that have gotten beautifully charred.
In New Orleans, they call it debris.
Yeah,
debris.
Debris.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Actually, another wonderful nibble on thing that he was actually making the last time we ate there, and we got it like still fresh and hot, is cracklins, which, you know, cracklins are kind of like bacon, but even better. I mean, they're basically crisp fried strands of pig fat,
which literally, I mean, literally melt in your mouth when you put one on your tongue.
Oh, so bad for you and so good. Yeah.
So bad for you. And what he did with these, I mean, we just noshed on some just straight from the pan, but what these were for was to put on top of his really good mashed potatoes. An excellent combination.
So this is actually a place where you can sit down and eat. Right.
Yes, there are booths. A lot of business is takeout, right. But there are booths where you can sit down. And if you do sit down there, Warren Norstein, the pitmaster, is one of these guys who's like a real host, you know, and he'll go around. And if he's got something coming out of the oven, he'll pass little samples of it. Once you're in there, you're sort of at a party, a barbecue party.
Right. Hey, guys, sounds great. Thank you.
It is. Bye-bye,
Linda. Worth the trip. Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, you can get their latest finds at splendidtable.org. And take a look at our quarterly ebook. It's called Eating In with Lynn. You get a menu, recipes, tips, and, of course, opinions. The summer party issue is coming out. Just head to the website, splendidtable.org. Often return from eating in places like Europe with this revelation. Waiting tables is a profession, a skilled one and a proud one. It's not the fill-in while you hunt for the real job. Restaurant reviewer Pascal Ledraulec learned this firsthand.
Elle avait sous sa toque de martre, sur la butte Montmartre.
Until the age of 7, I thought my father was a movie star. He left the house every day wearing a tuxedo and whistling Yves Montand, and he returned every night with pockets full of money. Edmond Louis Ledraulec was a waiter, not the kind who keeps a screenplay in his sock drawer, but a career waiter, right down to his collection of satin cummerbunds. Eddie, as he came to be known after moving to America, lived to seduce diners with his expertise and tableside charm. From the early 1960s through the late 1990s, he worked in some of Los Angeles's most celebrated dining rooms, Scandia, the Saloon, the Ambassador Hotel. Each morning before school, he would regale my sister and I with tales from his shift while sipping strong coffee out of a bowl. The chef was so angry, he flung a bread roll at Mario. The hostess is giving Jean-Louis all the best tables. C'est louche. The paparazzi were out in full force last night. We sat wrapped, spoonfuls of cream of wheat suspended mid-air. While he spoke, my mother would brush his tuxedo jacket, which smelled of shrimp scampi, cigarettes, and the burnt wood and bergamot of his cologne. She'd scatter the contents of its pockets on the table. Champagne corks, breath mints, the occasional escargot shell for his girls, and of course, cash. He's a keen storyteller, my father, and at work, he enthralled diners with stories of his childhood. In 1941, when he was barely 6, Edmond and his parents fled their native, then-occupied Brittany and hid out for over a year on the tiny island of Porquerolles in Provence, where food was scarce. I've often wondered if his career choice had something to do with silencing that hunger. At 16, now living with his parents in Nice, Edmond took a summer job as garçon de café at a beachside terrace. Instead of going back to school, as his parents wished, he signed up for fine dining training at a 5-star hotel in Evian. He never looked back. In his early 20s, he heard there was work at the Swank Beaver Club at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal and set sail across the Atlantic in 1960. There, he met my mother, Lucette, also fresh off the boat from France. She, too, had known hunger. He took her out for a steak dinner, but he was so smitten he couldn't eat. Lucette directed her fork at his T-bone. May I? They were married 6 months later. It was a potluck wedding. Every night, Edmond would bring his new bride treats from the Beaver Club, a ripe and runny camembert swiped from the cheese cart, an unfinished bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape. He presented each item with the flourish she deserved. Edmond and Lucette dreamed of sunny days, and so they bought an old Chevrolet and made their way to Route 66, which they followed until it ran into the Pacific Ocean in Santa Monica, California. They found an apartment on 9th Street the day they arrived. My father went out for a smoke. He poked his head inside a neighborhood restaurant called the San Francisco and was hired on the spot. Ultimately, a restaurant where waiters wore shorts was not a good fit for Eddie, and he quickly found work at Frascati's in Beverly Hills. And so it went for 50 years, changing jobs almost as often as he changed shirts. Finding work was never a problem. The network of French expat waiters was thick. Keeping jobs was another story. Eddie had little patience for those who didn't share his passion for the craft, who didn't see waitering as an art. A chef once fired him for refusing to deliver a steak he deemed overcooked. The owner hired him right back. Of course, there were other situations that sent my father onto the next gig. Yet, there were places where he stayed put, and despite the odd hours, my father was a family man. During the Scandia years, we would go camping at Leo Carrillo State Park near Malibu. Eddie couldn't afford to take any time off, so he would swim and hike with us by day, then drive to work in the afternoon. He'd primp in the campground showers and emerge in his Prussian blue tux with a golden emblem on his heart. The first thing I'd see when I'd unzip the tent flap in the morning was that showy blue jacket hanging from the high branch of a sycamore. No one was surprised when I became a food writer and eventually the restaurant critic at the Daily News in 2001. By then, my father's health had declined, and he wasn't able to travel much to the East Coast. Still, I felt him there with me, night after night, condemning a mere fish soup that dared call itself bouillabaisse, or praising the bartender who had bothered to float a lemon zest in my kir. On his last visit to New York, he accompanied me on a review of Thomas Keller's Per Se. The vaunted service was flawless. I wanted so badly to tell our designer-clad waiter that he was in the presence of a real pro. But by then, long retired, my father was ready to be fawned over, and that was gift enough.
Pascal Ledraulec's article, The Professional, appeared in Savour magazine. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it looked like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We've got Michael from Edmonds, Washington on the line. So, Michael, how are you?
I'm great, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. What's on your mind?
Well, my wife and I have donated an Italian dinner for an auction at our temple, and someone has purchased it, and we need to make the dinner now. So we have the main course all set. My wife's going to make her famous spaghetti and meatballs.
Oh, boy.
We'll make a nice salad, some homemade bread, but we're kind of stuck on the dessert and possible side dishes. So we want to do as much as we can in advance so that
right.
we're not having to, because we need to bring it to somebody's house and serve it.
I understand.
But we also want it to be really, really good.
Well, I think that, first of all, you've made a great choice because the spaghetti and the meatballs, you know, you can cook the pasta there.
Exactly, and have right. the meatballs done ahead of time.
Right, and the sauce and the whole thing, so that's taken care of. Now, the pasta should be served all by itself, you know, no, that's it. That's
the course.
Right.
But what you can do, and you can decide whether you want to do, traditionally the salads in Italy would be served after that course. And now you want to make the pasta the main course because it's really the meat and the pasta in that dish.
Yeah, exactly. This is, right. We build it as a spaghetti and meatballs dinner.
I understand. Well, you know, you may want to start with something kind of interesting, maybe do a little bit of an antipasto.
Okay.
For instance, you might want to take asparagus and scallions and roll them in olive oil and coarse salt and maybe some chopped capers. Okay.
Wow, that sounds really good.
Yeah, and then slow grill them.
Oh.
Or put them under the broiler. You can do this at room temperature, so you can
right.
do them ahead.
Right.
You can also do them there because they take – you put them in a on a big sheet pan, you
right.
know, or even on a cookie sheet, for goodness sakes.
We grill asparagus all the time. That's like,
right, you know. So, I mean, and you do it with the scallions too because the scallions – nobody ever thinks of a scallion as a vegetable,
mm-hmm.
which is a shame. And then what you do is you can put that – you can pile them side by side on a platter, or you can serve them, you know, however you want on an individual dish, and you drizzle them with a really good wine vinegar,
mm-hmm.
which would really be delicious. Or you could put a little balsamic, but you know, the balsamic thing's almost overdone, and I think it overwhelms the delicacy of the vegetables.
Okay.
So that's one thing you can do. And then the other thing is I would get some wonderful cheeses. Well, wait a minute. No, do you keep kosher?
This will not be like an official kosher meal. We'll have to talk to the host and figure out exactly how
okay.
they want to handle it.
All right. There's one wonderful thing you can do.
There's going to be Parmesan cheese in the meatballs, so probably not.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there you go. It's not going to be a kosher meal. Another great thing to do, I think, is to take almonds, whole almonds, and roast them with fresh thyme and fresh basil and grated lemon rind and a little olive oil and coarse salt. And you put that out with drinks. It's very, 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 very simple, and it's so easy and delicious.
That sounds really good. So
yeah.
When you do that, do you toss it with all the spices beforehand?
Yes, you toss them with the spices beforehand. Be careful, not too much of the oil.
Uh-huh.
You spread them out in a pan. You put them in a 350-degree oven, and you roast them until they have a lovely – you'll smell that nice toasty aroma.
Right, right.
Watch them closely. It's going to be 8 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
That's it. And then one of the other things that's great to do, and it's a nice contrast to the flavors of the asparagus and the scallions, is roast up some peppers – okay,
mm-hmm.
and chop up anchovies and garlic and let that marinate in lemon juice. Take strips of the roasted peppers and roll that around the two and stick a toothpick in it.
Oh, okay.
And then if you can find really, really, really flavorful little tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
take a piece, little piece of mozzarella, put that, open up the tomato, put that in the center of the tomato, wrap a basil leaf around it and stick a toothpick in that. And when you bite into it, you've got a little salad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another great thing that's fun to do, and I'm just rolling them off here.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Take fresh goat cheese.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Make little eggs out of it. Just roll it between your hands and roll that in chopped pistachio nuts. Roll another one in chopped chives. Roll another one in fresh oregano. And so on and so forth. And you put those out and we call them little goat's eggs.
Oh, awesome. Wow.
Yeah. So not a bad – you can have a whole selection of these things out. Or you can do a platter of mixed antipasti that you pass around beforehand.
Right. That sounds great.
Yeah. And good bread with that, obviously.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, lots of good bread. Oh,
excellent.
dessert. Yes, dessert. Okay, my all-time favorite dessert because it's so easy and everybody loves it. But maybe it's been done to death, but it's panna cotta.
Okay.
And you could do a panna cotta with a little fancy touch. You could do a panna cotta where you take whatever local fruit's in season.
Okay.
And you could cook down some of that fruit with whatever seasoning you like. I like cardamom and vanilla with things like berries, like cherries.
Uh-huh.
You know, cook that down with a bit of sugar. So you almost get a jam.
Uh-huh.
And it has a really interesting flavor. Then you make your panna cotta.
Okay.
All right. And then have little cups. And in the bottom of the cup, put some of that homemade jam of fresh fruit. And then you pour in the panna cotta.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
And chill it. And you can do that a day ahead and bring it
right.
over. Okay? And then top it with a cherry or whatever it is, you know, a piece of strawberry or whatever. And
got
you're
it.
Done.
You're done and it's fabulous.
Excellent.
It's going to be a good meal.
Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy.
Thanks,
take
Lynn.
Care. Bye.
Okay, bye.
I guess I got carried away. But you can do so much. And if you go to the market and just look at all the vegetables, just remember, in Italy, every single vegetable at one point or another meets up with the simple combination of oil and vinegar, and yet it always tastes different. So just keep that simplicity in mind. 800-537-5252. You can send us an email, splendidtable.org. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Brennan in Crawfordsville, Indiana, wants to know, what can he do with the liquid that he strains off of his yogurt to make Greek-style yogurt? Well, what that liquid is really kind of a form of whey. It's kind of acidic, but it's fabulous. If you're doing buttermilk anything, I mean, you know, pancakes, waffles, whatever, you can substitute some of this for the buttermilk. This is one of those things, too, that if you like real tang, it's great to add to a pan sauce. You know, let's say you've grilled a little bit of chicken and you want to have a kind of creamy sauce. So you could add heavy cream and this to the pan with a little bit of fresh lemon and just stir that around, just a dad of fresh lemon. Okay. And it's really an interesting combination. You can add that liquid to cream and let it culture. Leave it out overnight for about 24 hours, and you're going to get a sort of tangy form of sour cream, really delicious. So there's lots you can do with it. And by the way, you can freeze it. I mean, if you freeze it in the equivalent of an ice cube tray, every tray holds about a tablespoon, or two tablespoons, rather. So wherever buttermilk is called for, you could use a bit of this. And you can use it in cake recipes and biscuits and that kind of stuff. Give it a shot. 800-537-5252. Meredith is on the line from Los Angeles. Meredith, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's just great to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
So I have a mystery I hope you can help me with. I live near a grocery store that specializes in products that are used in Mexican cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And they have things like cactus leaves and hard-to-find chili peppers and you know, all kinds of cheeses and beans that you just wouldn't see
right. In
the ordinary American grocery store. So most of the time I can figure out what to do with the items that are unfamiliar to me, but not so with this thing I picked up recently, which is dried red corn. The kernel, they come in these bags, they're about 1 pound, and right. They look like they're sort of bulk. They almost look like they might be feed, except they're just beautiful. And obviously they're intended to be eaten. And I thought, wow, this might make really great popcorn. That was a mistake. It was truly just awful, you know?
Yeah. So does it have a very, very thick skin on the corn?
I think so. I think that's why it didn't really pop. It's got to be for something else. And then I went online and I tried to find what to do with it, and it was a sort of frustrating dead end. So I've got to know. This stuff is too pretty to donate to a horse.
You may have me stumped, but I'm wondering about something. First of all, I think this is a corn that you're going to cook.
Okay.
You're going to boil it like you would boil grain, or simmer it as you would boil or simmer grain.
That makes sense.
Now, I'm not sure at all what its traditions might be. I have no doubt that this is used in some really specific ways in certain parts of Mexico or on certain occasions. But one of the real basic stews in Mexico, and it's spread into our Southwest, is called pozole. And that's where you take the yellow or white corn, that the kernels are quite large. Are these big kernels? And do they?
They are. Yeah, they're like the size of, you know, those corn nuts.
Yes, yes. And do they smell like a corn tortilla, that perfumey smell?
I don't know. I'd have to drag them out and find out.
Because they may have been treated with lye or lime water, and then that essentially loosens the skin very slightly. It doesn't look that way when they're dried, but when you simmer that, the kernel opens up like a flower.
Wow.
And that is what is generally mashed and made into the corn tortillas. And it has that characteristic floury smell you get out of a corn tortilla. And it's delicious. It's called hominy in this country.
Yes.
Now,
okay. You
can stew this with any number of things, but if you're going to make the normal pozole, would be done with chunks of pork shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
That you have the corn cooking in water, and usually when the corn has already popped open a bit and is starting, just beginning to get tender, because depending on how old it is, it may take a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can add chunks of pork to that and green chilies.
Wow,
and a bit of garlic
good. And
a bit of oregano. It's not a complicated dish, but it is so good, I cannot tell you.
Well, those ingredients, I mean, how can you go wrong with that?
Exactly. And I always throw some onion in. Some people say if I do that, I have immediately ruined the dish. And you simmer it very, very gently until the pork is really tender. I like to leave it overnight so the fat rises to the surface of the stew and I can just take that fat off, but I still get all that flavor. But you want those kernels tender, and they're going to open up and literally start to kind of almost not petals, but they'll bump out and they'll be larger and they'll be tender and they'll be delicious because they'll have absorbed all that good taste.
Oh, that sounds great.
I think we're experimenting here. I would try cooking it on its own first and see what you get. Just put it in salted water and cook it on its own.
Okay.
And see what you get. If you get a lot of tough skins floating around, then what you might have to do is pre-cook those suckers and get the skin off, then stick them in the stew, you know, with their cooking water or whatever. But I do a little experiment first, but I have a feeling you're not going to need to worry.
I am so excited to try this.
Yeah, and they may take a long time to cook, so just be patient, okay?
Okay, thank you so much for your help with this.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Red corn, dried red corn. Now, you know, red corn, you find it in a lot of different areas in the Southwest. It's been grown for centuries. Really curious. I'm going to have to look for it. And you can look for us. You can go to Facebook. You can go to Twitter. Or you can go to our website, splendidtable.org. Or give us a call, 800-537-5252. They sound like nachos gone berserk. Toasty locos. John T. Edge wrote about them. He's the culinary historian with the great gig at the New York Times. He writes the United Tastes column. Now, that means he travels around finding what we're eating now, the local specialties that you rarely hear about. So John T. is here from his base camp at the University of Mississippi. John T., good to have you back with us.
I'm very glad to be back.
So, toasty loco, what is this and what does it taste like?
Well, you begin by opening a bag of Tostitos, usually the salsa verde flavored kind, and then you layer on ingredients. If you could imagine a cook in Tijuana, Mexico, or more accurately, an assembler of this dish in Tijuana, Mexico, ripping open that bag of salsa verde flavored Tostitos, and then taking the ingredients from three shelves in a bodega and dumping all of those in. And those ingredients include shaved jicama, pickled pig skins, these stumpy little sweet-sour tamarind candies, soy-coated peanuts, chopped cucumbers, and then they pulled out two liquids, usually. Fresh-squeezed limes, little key limes, those tiny little beautiful limes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then chamoy, that kind of magenta-colored, vinegary, puckery, pickled fruit and brine sauce that you see oftentimes when you see someone buying chips in the store, even when they're not buying Toasty Locos, you're handed a bottle of chamoy with which you garnish chips. All that goes in the bag. And the bag kind of bulges under that payload. And oftentimes the bag, when filled with all those ingredients, you know, the side slits and you start dripping this kind of Rorschach pattern on the pavement as you eat and walk.
Is it delicious? Because it sounds like it really could be.
It is delicious. It's one of the most texturally compelling dishes I've ever had because there's so much going on. There's so many layers of flavor.
So is this something that's been created in the border towns in Mexico? I mean, is this American influence on Mexican food, or is it Mexican food just borrowing some things from the United States?
Well, it's definitely a borderlands food, and it's a food to me that represents very well the kind of porosity of the border between Mexico and the U.S. And the way I came to think about it, doing research for this, and in talking to a young culinary researcher named Gustavo Arellano, it's almost like a Mexican reclamation effort. Like if American companies took tortilla chips and packaged them and sold them to everyone, that would be Tostitos, then Mexican Americans and Mexicans from Tijuana are reclaiming Tostitos chips from Mexico by adding all these things to it and creating a new product.
Yeah, so it's saying, hey, it's really ours.
Yeah.
So who eats them and how are they eaten and, you know, are they a big deal?
They are a big deal in Mexico, especially in the northern half of Mexico, especially in Tijuana and environs. You'll see them sold by the flats, pre-assembled, with the bearers carrying them on their heads at Mexican wrestling matches. You'll see them at the beach. You'll see them in movie theaters in custom Tostilocos carts. You'll see them also in these things called Tosti Centros, which are centers for selling Tostilocos. They're a big deal in Mexico, yes.
This sounds, I mean, I have to say, the more I think about it, the more I think it's crunchy, it's sweet, it's sour. It sounds really utterly delicious. John T., thanks so much.
My pleasure, Lynn.
John T. Edge is the author of The Truck Food Cookbook. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from George Carlin, who said, "The other night I ate at a real nice family restaurant. Every table had an argument going." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Consider splendidtable.org as your go-to source for great recipes, weekly e-newsletters, download our podcasts, and find information about anything you've heard here. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.